Northwestern Energy is buying all of PPL Montana's dams. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you how far the University of Montana student enrollment has dropped this fall. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has an update on a new biomass boiler in Columbia Falls. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with environmental law expert Robin Craig about the impact of climate change on the world's water. Northwest Energy has reached an agreement to buy 11 hydroelectric power plants from PPL Montana, all of their Montana dams, for $900 million. The companies announced the deal today after the stock market closed. Northwestern CEO Bob Rowe says the purchase is a long-term investment and commitment to the company's operations in Montana.
We're buying the dams at a market price, but we think a market price that is fair for our customers, and at a point where the market is relatively low. If we had purchased the same set of assets just several years ago, we would have been paying more.
Rowe says owning the dams will give Northwestern's Montana customers stable rates over the long term.
This will significantly diversify our portfolio. In the first year out of the resources that we actually own, hydro would then be about 44%. That helps with a couple of things. First, helps with fuel price risk, and then also certainly risk associated with any future environmental regulation of coal.
The agreement does not include PPL Montana's interest in the Colstrip power plant or its J.E. Corret coal-fired facility near Billings, and it does not include PPL Energy Plus, a power marketing and trading operation based in Butte. Rowe is clearly pleased with the deal and thinks Montanans should be too.
As a Montanan and as a customer, I think it will be great to know as you drive along the river and look over at one of the dams that a significant part of the electricity that you're using comes from those facilities. Just as a Montana citizen who takes advantage of all that Montana has to offer, it's, I think, great to know that those facilities in all of their attributes are going to be well-maintained and are going to be dedicated to serve Montana customers for I hope for as long as there's water in the rivers.
The sale is expected to close in the second half of 2014 and requires regulatory approval.
And in other news from around the state, Montana prison officials have released a former high school teacher after he completed a 30-day sentence for raping a 14-year-old girl who later committed suicide. 54-year-old Stacy Rambold's sentence is under review by the state's high court and has prompted critics to call for the removal of the judge who oversaw the case. District Judge G. Todd Baugh drew outrage last month over the sentence's leniency and comments he made that appeared to pin some of the blame on the victim. State prosecutors are appealing the sentence, saying Rambold should have received a minimum of 2 years. But barring new offenses, the former teacher has served his time and will stay out of prison pending the appeal. Under the terms of his release, Rambold cannot return to teaching.
The University of Montana's fall semester enrollment stands at 14,525 students. That's 418 fewer than last year, but Provost Perry Brown says that's about 45 more students than they expected. UM's 2012 fall semester enrollment declined over 700 from autumn and but from 2011, which set a record of 15,669 students. In the last 2 years, student enrollment has dropped by over 1,100 students from that peak. Brown says there are few factors at play.
We graduated for the last couple of years fairly large classes. We have a smaller class that came in last year that's working its way through the system, so the numbers are already down to start with. So we had anticipated a modest drop in numbers, but we actually exceeded our projections. So the 14,525 is higher than we anticipated that it would be.
Enrollment at Montana State University, meanwhile, topped 15,000 students for the very first time this semester.
Well, a couple of things. One is that, and we have said this before, that they started with a really aggressive recruitment program a little bit sooner than we did. In addition, they have significant numbers of students coming into engineering programs, which we do not have.
When asked if recently concluded investigations into UM by the NCAA and the U.S. Department of Justice could have had any bearing on enrollment, Brown answered by saying, quote, it's possible. New student recruiting yielded 3,418 new students, just three more than a year ago. Brown says UM has launched new initiatives to attract prospective students.
We have put in place programs now that will have far more physical contact and things, materials that are in the hands of students and or prospective students and their parents. So we have made major changes in that area. We've added funding for recruitment activities in terms of our recruitment people being out and about. So we've added funding in that area. We've added funding in scholarships that we can provide to students so that they can be here. We've also upped our contracts with national companies that help in recruiting, like Ruffalo Cody, and they will help us make more contacts and actually do more screening for us on prospective students. So there's just a number of things that we're doing right now that are changing the way that we are in the recruiting game, and those should have really positive effects for us.
Brown says UM's new recruiting blitz is costing in excess of $500,000, a recent and significant investment that he hopes will start paying dividends by next fall. The student headcount at the two-year college Missoula is 2,467, nearly identical to last year. UM's graduate student enrollment is 2,271, which again nearly equals last autumn.
I'm not sure that that's concerning. I think that's a good number to have, is that we're about the same place that we were last year, because actually Missoula College was part of the decrease in the previous year, and now they're really identical to last year, the same place. We don't have any further erosion, and so I think we are, in fact, attracting people that want to be in that program or the set of programs that they have, and I think we'll have some others. Also, the graduate enrollments really do fluctuate from year to year. In this particular case, we have a graduate enrollment that is really pretty darn strong, and that we are able to serve those that we have. So I'm not overly concerned about that at all. I think we're doing a very good job there.
Brown says it's just too soon to know how the enrollment figures could potentially affect budgeting decisions at the University of Montana. He says much more analysis of the available data is needed.
Lawmakers are being told that state finances are in a bit better shape than originally predicted. Analysts told the Legislative Finance Committee today that it has finalized its look at spending for the state's budget year that ended in July. They found that the state spent a little less than expected and tax collections were higher than expected. In total, the state wrapped up the two-year budget period with a surplus of about $537 million. That is roughly $100 million more than lawmakers originally predicted. Some of the extra surplus will be set aside into a new account lawmakers established to pay for future firefighting costs. The rest will be used to buoy the surplus of the current budget period.
What's so special about the new biomass boiler at Columbia Falls Sawmill is how it serves multiple purposes. It burns off woody debris generated in the course of the sawmill process, with steam being used to kiln dry lumber and to power a turbine to produce energy, which the mill sells. Flathead reporter Catherine Fry has more from F.H. Stoll's Land and Lumber Mills cogeneration plant just days before its contract with the local electric cooperative takes effect.
Yeah, so we can go around out here outside a little bit, and then I'll take you in. We actually have the turbine online right now.
Cogeneration plant manager Brian O'Connor with F.H. Stoltz Land and Lumber says they've been producing energy for the power grid since earlier this summer.
With our bypass fuel system, we've been supplying the turbine on and off, not steadily, during the last few months. And so we have been on the grid. We've closed in. We've fulfilled all the requirements for BPA, Flathead Electric, all the entities involved. So we've proven that we can make power, and now we're just putting the final touches on a few of the conveyors.
The conveyors move bark and sawdust from the mill and wood chips from the planer to one of two silos. This fuel is mixed together, the dried out chips with the bark and sawdust, and then burned in the biomass boiler. By blending them together, O'Connor says they burn more efficiently and help the plant meet emissions controls and produce enough steam to both dry lumber in the kiln and to power the turbine, which produces energy for the grid.
So that's where the term cogeneration comes from, using the steam to turn a turbine and then also go do work in your process.
O'Connor says many manufacturers use this idea, not just the lumber industry.
People run their steam through a turbine and then extract it, and they can use that to do a number of different things. You can heat buildings, you can actually use steam absorption chillers, and you can actually do air conditioning with steam.
On October 1st, a power purchase agreement between FH Stoltz and the Flathead Electric Co-op takes effect. FEC will buy up to 2.5 megawatts annually for 20 years. That'll be enough to power between 1,800 and 2,500 homes. The co-op gets most of its energy through the Bonneville Power Administration, but has been expanding its alternative energy portfolio. The Stoltz project joins the Landfill Gas to Energy project, which produces about 1.6 megawatts. The co-op also recently gave the city of Whitefish an advance to buy power from a hydro plant the city is rebuilding.
This is the generating end. This is where we're making the electricity and sending it to the grid.
The start of the contract represents the end of a multi-year process for FH Stoltz. First, they had to raise the $22 million for the facility, which was done through private investment and grants, including from the U.S. Forest Service. Then they had to ensure a buyer for their energy and worked with Flathead Electric on the power purchase agreement. Then they had to build the cogeneration plant, make sure the engineers had updated training, and hire new staff.
We're finally at the point where we're putting power on the grid and ready to start our contract. And it's a great feeling. It's exciting. And we're very, very happy to have forged this contract with Flathead Electric. And it's just, we think, a great thing for our company and for the Valley.
The new cogeneration plant is all digital, with computers monitoring everything from the mix of the fuel to how much fuel goes into the boiler to how much energy the turbines are producing. It replaces a more than 100-year-old boiler that was used to burn the same bark, sawdust, and planer chips, but without the added bonus of producing electricity for sale. Katrin Fryt reporting from the Flathead.
One of the resources most directly impacted by climate change is water. It's an issue Robin Cundis Craig knows a lot about. Craig teaches law at the University of Utah and is an expert on the Clean Water Act and environmental law. She is in Missoula to speak at the law school about climate change. In this feature interview, Craig talks with News Director Sally Mock about why she says climate change is a different kind of water quality problem.
Especially if you're thinking in terms of law and policy, because it's not under immediate human control. To the extent it's anthropogenic at all, the sources of the problems are greenhouse gas emissions into the air, which even if we stop them tomorrow, we're looking at century probably before we start noticing changes in the concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, just because it takes so long for carbon dioxide to cycle out. So we need to be thinking in terms of, given that we can't do it, like with most water pollution, you can say to people, stop putting that in the river. And they comply, they come up with technology, they find out some other treatment for it. With this, the changes that climate change is bringing to water quality, such as changes in temperature, which are important to Montana's trout, among other things, just can't be dealt with the same way. And so we need to come up with some more creative policy measures for dealing with those impacts that can't be immediately regulated away.
As you mentioned, in Montana, we already know about the impact on fish. We're having some rivers and streams that are closed to fishing during prime fishing season these days because the water temperature has gotten too high and the fish are stressed by that. But you've also written that the warmer waters of these rivers and streams are going to infect a lot more than fish. Power plants, for example, some of which depend upon cooler water to cool their plants.
Yes, I think that's going to be a huge problem, and the Department of Energy is well aware of it. As most power plants, and kind of regardless of what fuel they use. So nuclear power plants, coal-fired power plants, natural gas power plants, they all need cooling systems. Traditionally, the cheapest and easiest way to cool down a power plant is to bring in cold water. And historically, the concern has been the temperature of the water going out the other side. We don't want to be discharging boiling water into a trout stream, for example. But now there's been a lot of problems during heat waves, even in the southeast where there's plenty of water. The problem isn't the lack of water. The problem is it's just too hot to use as cooling water. And so several states in the southeast had to ramp down nuclear power plants in particular because the water just wasn't cold enough to do the job. That's scary for a number of reasons. Mucking with nuclear power plants is its own issue, but also that what that does to the electricity that's available for people to use. If you're already in a heat wave, what that does to people's ability to keep themselves cool and avoid heat stroke and other human health related problems is a follow-on consequence. So warming temperatures in the waters for whatever reason. There's less water. It's just too hot. The air temperatures are up.
You're an expert on the Clean Water Act, and you've also written about how that act is really not able, as it's written, to respond to climate change. It's an act that depends upon things that climate change is changing.
It is, and in particular, the act requires that anything that could be done in the waterways in the period between 1972 and 1975 could never be removed. So states have to preserve, they're called existing uses, all uses that existed in their waterways 1972 to 1975. And under the current act and the current regulations, there's no real way around that. Now, I think EPA could amend its regulations to put some flexibility in there.
And why should they, do you think?
Well, because of problems like hot trout in Montana and hot salmon in the Pacific Northwest otherwise. These are problems that states can't solve. If their streams are supposed to have cold water fish in them and the water is just too hot to support those fish populations, the states end up being in perpetual violation of the Clean Water Act for a problem they can't fix. I mean, you can only shade streams so far. That's one possible solution. But otherwise, you're looking at pumping in chilled water, and that just gets prohibitively expensive. Plus, you probably need the water for something else, too. So I think the Clean Water Act and the EPA need to be adjusted, the EPA needs to rethink that some of these challenges are, in fact, not able to be regulated out of existence. Now, they have to be very careful, and I've said this as well, that they don't open a door so wide that states can willy-nilly avoid protecting uses they still could protect. But for some things like hot water or severely reduced stream flows that are going to change aquatic biology and ecology, we need an out, or we're just going to have states that are always in violation of their water quality standards.
One thing you wrote, which intrigued me, is that the notion of sustainability is now obsolete because of climate change. And I want to read a quote of something you wrote about that, and it says this: when the only constant in life is continual socio-ecological change, sustainability is a practically meaningless concept. You can't sustain an ecosystem if the fundamental features of that ecosystem are constantly changing.
I stand by that statement. Climate change is a game changer. And I think we're just starting to see some of those impacts. In Montana, it's the streams and the trout. I also do work in ocean and coastal law.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the
oceans. Yeah, we haven't talked about the oceans yet, but Oregon, Washington, Maine are all seeing impacts on their fishing and their aquaculture from what's going on in the oceans, both changing currents and ocean acidification. And sustainability, however well or badly it's been defined in prior contexts, and that's a whole other debate, is fundamentally about keeping some standard of living, some standard of ecological reality, some standard of human comfort that depends fundamentally on conditions remaining more or less the same, natural variability, but we can depend on the Colorado River having X amount of water. We can depend on snowmelt being in May rather than in March.
And we can predict.
And we can predict what's going to happen. And climate change alters all of that. We don't know in a lot of cases what the future is going to look like. Species are already moving, both terrestrially, aquatically, and in the marine environment. They're changing their ranges. We don't know what our water dependability is going to be in the future. We don't know what the new normal is going to look like, or if we're going to have a new normal that lasts anywhere more than a decade or two.
Let me interject. Your grim prognosis, this is how you've described it, quote, at least three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, war, famine, and death, are likely to be riding tall and strong through the climate change era.
If we don't do anything, if we don't start adapting to this new reality, I stand by that prediction as well, that famine, food security is already an issue. If you think about the wheat crises and the rice crises that have occurred over the last decade, fishing crises are starting to occur in the oceans. Famine is going to be a big one. When people get starving and hungry, they start fighting, and so...
And when they're displaced.
And when they're displaced, if you've got refugees running... And international law has not dealt at all with the problem of climate change refugees, of which there already are some and are likely to be thousands, if not millions more in the future. So when people are moving around, when people are desperate, you start having other social problems.
You have also, though, written about the need to adapt,
mm-hmm.
and you quote Charles Darwin on that. And you
well,
say,
purportedly Charles Darwin.
Purportedly yeah. Charles Darwin. And the quote is, it's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change.
Yes.
The ones who adapt.
The ones who adapt. Shorter way of phrasing it, adapt or die. And I think that's where we are, and I think it's a social phenomenon as much as an ecological phenomenon, and that's why I use the phrase socio-ecological systems, because both parts are important. But the more that people try to hold on to what they consider the old reality, the more costly and the more painful the adaptation process is going to be. We're at a moment now where we know change is coming, where we can build flexibility into our laws and our other social systems, where we can anticipate some of the more obvious changes that are coming, but also gear people into thinking that they can't expect that their next decades will be like life has in their memories always been. And I think we can much better prepare everybody for, you know, change is your new reality, and you need to not hang on so tightly, which I realize runs counter to some very strong human impulses, but not hang on so tightly to what you think life should be, and with more open eyes be dealing with life as it's becoming and life as it may be in the future. And I think part of that will be we're going to have to swing the pendulum back on law and policy to a more community-based as opposed to individual-based view of the universe.
Especially when it comes to water.
Especially when it comes to water. That a lot of the community doctrines, like in California and other parts of the Southwest, there were Pueblo rights that were based on community. Utah Mormons had a community-based system of water. I think that's going to make a lot more sense in a lot of instances for dealing with and adapting to climate change impacts, particularly for water.
Well, I have been speaking with Robin Cundis Craig, who teaches law at the University of Utah and has written a lot about environmental law and about the Clean Water Act. And Dr. Craig, it's been a pleasure to have you in our studio to talk about water. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been nice to be here.
And now for tonight's weather forecast. For west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect partly cloudy skies with fog. Lows will be in the 20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow look for partly cloudy skies with highs in the 50s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies, then becoming partly cloudy. Lows will be in the lower 30s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with highs around 50 to 60 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow showers. Lows will be around 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming clear. Highs will be around 45 to 55 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Evan Barrett.
After many years away from the formal classroom, I am teaching again. When I left graduate school in 1968, I was hired on to teach civics to high school seniors. I ended up with a different teaching position, and after 1 year of teaching, I took a 44-year fork in the road. Instead of teaching civics, I entered the real world of civics, the world of government and politics. Over that period, I was heavily engaged in government at local, state, and federal levels, working for and with governors, senators, congressmen, legislators, local government officials. Despite the low esteem in which folks in government politics are often held, and a general disdain for government by many, I have learned that the proper functioning of our government is the bedrock upon which our successful democracy stands, that one could aspire to no more nobler role than that of public servant, making a positive difference in the lives of others. But I also learned that an equal or perhaps even more important role is that of being an active and informed citizen. A friend and I have been having long discussions about this lately, but it is not a new subject. Thomas Jefferson once said, and I quote, "An enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic." And more recently, Ralph Nader said, "There can be no daily democracy without daily citizenship." They are absolutely right. Yet today, here in the United States, meaningful citizen participation in our government is at a nadir. Adults and youth have a demonstrable lack of knowledge and understanding of history, geography, economics, and government. Between presidential elections, there is a general disengagement of the voting public. We have an obvious decline in the civility in American politics. Just read the blogs or listen to talk radio. In the media, there is a triumph of celebrity over substance. I believe all this is at least partially because we no longer really teach and learn about civics. A 2006 National Geographic Society poll found that 88% of young Americans could not find Afghanistan on a map, while 75% couldn't locate Israel or Iran either. The frightening thing is that by 2010, kids scored even worse than in 2006. Now, there are some efforts being made to help, among them a web-based program supported by retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, a regular visitor to Montana who recently received an honorary degree at UM. O'Connor believes that the fundamental purpose of public education in America has always been to build good citizens. She has warned that, quote, "Ill-informed high school students soon become ill-informed citizens." She has further noted that less than half of Americans today can name all three branches of the government, yet three in four can name all of the three stooges. That, my friends and fellow citizens, is not acceptable. We need more civics in the classroom, and in getting started, or should I say restarted, and restoring civics to the curriculum in our schools, public and private alike, and at all levels, we should not just offer classes in civics, we should require them. So as I teach 20th century Montana history here at Highlands College and honors classes about Butte at Montana Tech, my thoughts and efforts turn to building better citizens. Our education policymakers, elected and appointed, need to do the same. Over the last 9 years, Governor Schweitzer and Bullock have strongly recommitted Montana to its historic tradition of support for education. kindergarten and early childhood education are more available. College is becoming more affordable and accessible. Yet too many people see education only functionally as a route to a good job. It is that, but education must be even more. It needs to be a route to better citizenship. The people need it, but our state and country also need it. Yes, we need better citizens if we are to extend the life of the longest functioning democracy in the world. And the first step to better citizenship is to require all students to take meaningful civics classes at all levels. This is Evan Barrett in Butte, thinking about building better citizens through civics.
Evan Barrett is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening.